So has the level of food insecurity increased in New Zealand? Well, because we don't have recent national data, I can't really answer that question. But just to draw your attention to the Adult Nutrition Survey, which was carried out in 2008 and 2009, this will give some really good comparative data once that's been analysed. And so we'll be able to have a look at the prevalence of food insecurity within the context of an economic recession. So who does food insecurity affect? So as John alluded to earlier, households that are living in deprived areas, households with children, and so what we find is the more children within the household, usually the greater the degree of food insecurity. It's also higher in households which are headed by younger adults compared to those with older adults, and also in New Zealand Māori and Pacific families. And what we've also found recently with the two research projects I've been involved in, and this mirrors data from overseas, single-parent families are more likely to be food insecure and are also more likely to be experiencing food insecurity at that lower level. Households that are receiving government benefits as the main source of income, and also households that are renting rather than have a mortgage. Okay, so what are some of the solutions which could be suggested to improve the situation for these families? So these are things which we could probably all just suggest ourselves. So they wouldn't have enough, they would have enough money if they budgeted properly. They should spend more time cooking. People on low incomes buy too much ready-to-eat food. They don't know how to shop wisely. And they could just grow, they could grow their own vegetables. So these are some kind of suggestions or solutions at the individual behavioural level. And then we've got some policy solutions. And these are some suggestions which came out of the Enhance report, which was a very big report which was produced by a team from different universities around New Zealand, and it was based on a very large review of the international and New Zealand literature, and also it included workshops with people who were experts in the area. And so some of the solutions that they came up with at a policy level included removing GST on food, discounts or subsidies on healthy food, and also improving physical access to food. But apart from the SHOT study, where we've got some very interesting information and data on removing the GST on food, we really don't have too much information in New Zealand on behavioural or lifestyle habits in regard to food degree of food security. And we also don't have much information on the physical access issue. And so the exploratory survey I did, the Family Food Environment Survey, was an attempt to gather some information about New Zealand families and the context in which they were choosing food and eating. And we examined quite a lot of different issues, physical access to food, food purchasing patterns, budgeting, the use of ready-to-eat food, the utilisation of home gardens, the amount of time spent in food preparation, and eating together as a family. And we compared these by both food security status and by household income. So unfortunately not going to have enough time to present to you all of those results today, so I'm just going to touch on a few of them. One very interesting thing, which seems quite logical, but I think this is quite essential in terms of understanding the issue of food insecurity in these families, is that the households with low and moderate food insecurity used food as a flexible part of their budget that they could manipulate and change depending on what was happening that week. So they were able to, they would reduce their expenditure on food to maintain other expenses such as rent, mortgage, power, petrol and insurance. And I think this is something that's good to remember, because improving food insecurity isn't just about looking at the issue of food. It's also about looking at other household expenses. And if we could ease the economic restraint on those expenses, it would probably have a flow-on effect in terms of how much people are able to spend on food. And so we were interested in how food insecurity impacted on how much they're spending on food and what they're buying. So on this table, we've just got the two groups here, the food secure group and the food insecure group. And you can clearly see this is on a per person per week basis, that those in the food insecure group were spending approximately $10 less per person, so this is equivalent to an adult female, on food per week. And what was really interesting is that they were reducing their expenditure on fresh vegetables, so that was quite different there. Not so much on fruit, and milk was kept very consistent between the two groups. What we also found was that the food insecure households also prioritised expenditure on meat, even though they were probably spending money on lower quality meat. So we had a look at this data in a little bit more detail by just taking out the households which were food insecure and comparing it. So you can see there we've got the moderately food secure group and the low food secure group. And you can see in the low food secure group, they were reducing expenditure on snacks, cakes and biscuits and non-alcoholic beverages in comparison to the moderately food secure group. So they weren't spending their money on empty calories. They were maintaining expenditure on food such as milk. But you can see there as well quite a big difference in terms of expenditure on bread. And this probably represents the low food secure group buying a lower quality bread at cheaper prices. So this research, the Family Food Environment Survey, led us onto a second project, which is called the SPEND Study. And this study is in food insecure households only. So we've got 200 families we recruited from Dunedin. They all had some level of food insecurity. And what we've done with these families is collected quite a bit of demographic baseline data on them and looked at the degree of food insecurity that they're experiencing. But what we've also done is designed an intervention study for these families where we've given half of them some extra money in terms of supermarket vouchers to spend on food. And so what we're comparing is what difference this money makes in terms of what they're buying and what they're able to purchase when they're doing their food shopping. So we're collecting food shopping receipts to measure this. So I'm sorry I've not been able to talk about all of the results from the Family Food Environment Survey, but I hope that's given you a little bit of a taster. So just to conclude, the majority of low-income households in the Family Food Environment Survey were not food secure. Economic constraint could impact on the ability to make healthy food choices. And sorry I've not been able to present data for this, but the utilisation of ready-to-eat food was similar by both income and food security status, but the types of ready-to-eat food differed between the groups. And what we found within the city environments of Dunedin and Wellington was that physical access for these families was not really an issue in terms of access to food. And so few behavioural changes have the potential to impact on food security unless the upstream financial constraints are addressed. I'd just like to acknowledge quickly the supervisors for my project who've been very supportive, Associate Professor Winston Parnell and Dr. Rachel Brown, and also Andrew Gray, all from the University of Otago, who's helped with biostatistics. And the Families Commission, who partly funded one of my projects, and also all the research assistants who've helped with interviewing. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Claire. Look, I'm just going to unmute everyone, so it might get a little bit noisy just for a moment while everyone comes off mute. But we're open for Q&A now, so if you do have a question, please state your name and publication before you ask a question. But go ahead if there's any questions there on the conference.
Kent Atkinson, Adenza PA.
Go ahead, Kent.
I'm interested in what evidence in the studies that have been talked about so far the two participants see for benefits in removing GST from things that are regarded as healthy foods.
I'll go first, shall I?
Yes, please.
I'll just go back to the shop study, which I think is probably one of the most convincing studies that we have, which I think does demonstrate that removing the GST, well, 12.5% on healthy food, actually changed people's purchasing behaviours from baseline to 6 months later. There was a change, but also in relation to other kinds of interventions, there was a difference. So I think the SHOP study, which was a randomised controlled trial, very, very well conducted. It didn't use recall or anything like that, which are often major flaws in trying to track what people have purchased. They actually were able to use individual supermarket sales data through a very, very sophisticated methodology. So this is really hard, crunchy data that they were able to collect, which I think provides very persuasive evidence that reducing, giving price discounts to healthy food actually changed people's purchasing behaviours. And that was highly significant.
Thank you.
I think
what you're asking for,
that addresses it.
Thank you.
I guess my one comment on that is yes, it does show really good evidence. The issue I think we have is how do we define a healthy food? And I would probably argue that it would be great to remove the GST on all foods, not just healthy foods.
Mm-hmm. The corollary to that, of course, is the question of what advantage you would see in placing a greater financial penalty or greater financial cost on foods regarded as unhealthy, for instance, empty calories and takeaway foods.
Mm. Mm. So,
taxing takeaways.
Yeah. So, you know, how does this stack up with a tax on unhealthy foods? And I don't know any data. I don't know any studies that have actually looked at that. You could argue that because disadvantaged people tend to eat more of those, that might actually provide an added burden to them. I mean, you know, well, the best intentions are there, that we want to tax these foods and make them less desirable from a financial point of view, but it is often the case that because disadvantaged groups tend to buy more of those, you might actually be compounding the problem. So I don't know any work that has looked at a fat tax in any systematic way compared, for example, to the SHOP study that I keep referring to. I don't know anything that's really tested that. But from a public health point of view, I'm more interested in making things easier rather than making things more difficult, if you like. And so I think that's why I'm very much persuaded by the SHOP study, which I think falls into the let's try to make things easier by making them cheaper category.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for that, Kent. Any other questions there on the conference?
Yeah, it's Rebecca Todd with the Press in Christchurch.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Question for John. When you talked about the healthy food basket and the percentage that people spend on a healthy food basket, how would that compare with a regular food basket or a unhealthy? Do you know what I mean? Is there a greater difference in the percentage of household spending a, you know, a more disadvantaged family would have to spend on healthy as opposed to what they would regularly buy?
Yes. We, well, with the data we've got here, Rebecca, is from our household food, household expenditure survey, which is conducted reasonably regularly in Australia. There is a component, a food component in that. And we know from that that normally disadvantaged households spend about 18% of, well, 18% of overall household expenditure goes on food. 80% of that goes on food. So we've got a bit of an indication there. So, yes, people would be spending a lot more than they would normally spend on the healthy food basket. And I think I really like Claire's study. I really, really like this study because I think that one of the things we have faced in this area is people saying, well, you know, if only disadvantaged groups would kind of eat less snack foods or eat fewer empty calories, you know, they would free up money for healthy food. And I think if I understood Claire's study correctly, she is able to show that, in fact, they're not spending more than other groups in terms of empty calories. They've already cut back on empty calories. Is that right, Claire?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So I think that's a really, really important piece of work because, again, I think it addresses a bit of a myth out there that usually if all these people need to do is to cut back on unnecessary foods to free up money for healthy foods. And I think Claire's study demonstrates that, in fact, there's not a lot of, you know, they're already cutting back on so-called unhealthy foods, empty calories.
And one thing I didn't actually allude to in the talk was another thing we looked at was the use of the ready-to-eat foods, so kind of convenience-type foods. And what we found between different income groups was a very similar use in terms of the frequency in which that they would eat out or that they would get convenience foods. But the amount that they spent differed quite a lot. So the low-income group obviously only had a certain amount to spend, and so the choices that they had in terms of the ready-to-eat food were naturally the unhealthier versions. So they were more so the fish and chips as opposed to going out to a restaurant. So there was a similar kind of need for this convenience, but the choice was definitely limiting.
Can I just add something else here, please? And that is that we know that if people are paying 30% or more of their income on their housing, whether that's the mortgage or rent, we call that housing stress. And I think we're now starting to use a language like food stress, where low-income people, to eat healthily, they might have to part with 30% of their income on a healthy diet. And we're starting to use this term food stress to indicate that it really does have a real effect on people's ability to eat healthily.
Okay, thanks for that, John. Any other questions on the conference?
Ken Atkinson at Enter PA.
Go ahead, Ken.
I'd be interested in a brief comment from either or both of the speakers on the issue of whether there would be significant advantage from modern families returning to growing more food in their own gardens.
I'll just butt in there, Ken. We looked at, we asked our families in Dunedin and Wellington, so they're living in cities, whether or not they were growing their own fruit and vegetables. And what we found was that about 50% were having a vegetable garden, but the types and the amount that they were growing was quite limited. So it was, I guess, that time issue. But what we did find was that the lower socioeconomic groups were less likely to grow fruit, and this was mainly because, and vegetables, although the difference wasn't as great. But this was mainly because they were renting and maybe moving around a little bit more. And so that the establishment of a vegetable patch was a bit more difficult for them. Or the landlord was maintaining the gardens. So I think that in terms of vegetable plots, the amount of time and skill involved is quite a lot. And I'd be interested in research which could show how much time and how big a plot you would need to actually contribute substantially to the nutrition of the household.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Ken. Probably time for one more question if anyone has anything left to ask. No, okay, in that case, I think I'll draw things to a close. Look, this presentation has been recorded, so that will be uploaded to the Science Media Centre website in the next half hour or so, so you can go and play that back. All the slides from the presentation are in the resource library of the Science Media Centre website, so you can access those there. Both of our speakers are available for interviews. John is still in Adelaide. He'll be heading over to New Zealand tomorrow for the conference. Both of them will be available for interviews, so if you'd like to get in touch with them, just contact us here at the SMC and we'll put you in touch. So I'd just like to close by thanking John and Claire, our two speakers today, for those fantastic presentations outlining some really interesting research. So, John, I hope you have a safe trip over. Pack something warm because it's still very much winter here in New Zealand.
I'll take your advice. Peter, thank you very much for making all this easy.
Okay.
Really appreciate it.
Okay, and thank you to everyone who asked questions. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.